Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This hour, we're going to look at our nation's dependence on prison labor. Good morning. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. You might be surprised by just how many products and services you've purchased that have involved prison labor. Companies such as Whole Foods, Victoria's Secret, AT&T, and Starbucks have all, at one point or another, contracted cheap labor through correctional facilities. In August, prisoners across the country went on strike to protest what they called modern slavery and the profits private companies make from their forced labor. Last month, when a wildfire in Northern California rapidly got out of control, now known as the Camp Fire, hundreds of the firefighters sent to combat the blaze were prisoners working to get their sentences reduced. They were paid $2 a day flat fee plus a dollar an hour for every hour that they were actively firefighting. This hour, we're going to look at prison labor in the United States, its ties to slavery, and we're going to look at recent efforts to reform it. Joining me now from Las Vegas is law professor Ruben Garcia. He's co-director of the University of Nevada Las Vegas Workplace Law Program. Good morning, Ruben.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined via Skype from Boston by Beth Schwartz-Apfel, staff writer at the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization focused on the criminal justice system. Beth, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So first to you, Ruben Garcia, why should prisoners get paid for their labor? They're in prison to be punished.
Well, this stems from part of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that provides an exception from slavery and involuntary servitude for those who have been convicted of a crime. And that, of course, goes back to 1865. And as history tells us, that exception was a way to obtain replacement labor after slavery in many of the United States. So that the genesis of that kind of exception or that kind of perception is rooted, I think, in the idea of having a subordinate labor force. And so if we perpetuate that in today's economy, that we may be perpetuating some of the worst ills of slavery. So there's, since 1865, of course, we've had a number of other labor regulations, and the economy and the law of the workplace has changed tremendously. You know, in before 1935, workers didn't have the right to join a union. They could be fired or jailed for joining a union. And 1935, the Congress passed federal labor law to allow workers the right to organize. And after 3 years after that, passed a piece of legislation called the Fair Labor Standards Act, which required a minimum wage and overtime for all employees. So, So now in today's question, we have, are these prisoners employees doing work for an employer? And, and that is, I think, the ongoing question that a lot of people are asking.
So for someone who doesn't currently have any family or friends in prison, why should they care whether a prisoner gets paid or not for their labor?
I think it goes, yeah, I think it goes partly to the reasons that we have the minimum wage and overtime rules to begin with. And that is that to provide a level playing floor, to provide fair competition among employers, to not have some employers, you know, work below the line and reap the advantages of that and bring all wages and working standards down. I think those are the reasons that all of us should be concerned about part of our economy that is working below the line or below the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Beth Schwartz-Apfel, this past election, voters in Colorado approved Amendment A, which basically outlaws the use of forced prison labor. How big a deal is this?
The passage of that law in Colorado was largely symbolic because all of the prison labor in Colorado is technically considered voluntary. So none of the people in prison doing work in Colorado would be affected by this provision. I do think it raises these complicated questions, though, about what voluntary means in a context like prison, where does voluntary mean you can sit in your cell or you can mop the floors? It's your choice. You can sit in your cell or you can make $1 an hour doing dangerous work. It's your choice. There's definitely some questions about coercion and voluntariness when you're talking about prison labor. But in this context, those jobs are all considered voluntary.
You mentioned dangerous work conditions. What kind of work conditions are prisoners subjected to?
Well, there's a very wide range. You know, I think prisons are inherently dangerous. So just being in prison is dangerous, first of all. But there are instances where prisoners have been involved in work programs that lead to lifelong medical problems. There was one documented instance where there was an electronics recycling program at federal prisons that led to where people weren't using safety equipment. They weren't using proper ventilation. And both inmates and correctional officers involved in this program ended up with lifelong problems, cancers, abortions, things like that. And then there are, you know, just sort of more routine jobs like working in the kitchen, working in the warden's office. I think the issue there is not necessarily that any of these jobs are inherently dangerous in the way that this electronics recycling program was. It's more just that there's no protections. That, you know, you can't file for disability insurance if you hurt yourself. It's more that you don't really have anyone safe to complain to if the conditions are dangerous. You can complain to OSHA, but they need to give advance notice to the prison before they can come inspect a work site. That's not how it is in a free world workplace. So all of the things that ensure that our workplaces are safe are not there in prison. And one of the primary things just worth noting is competition, right? A way that an employer hangs on to an employee is by providing a workplace that an employee wants to work at. And if the workplace is not a desirable workplace, the employee can leave and take another job. And, you know, that in a capitalist system is a motivator for an employer to provide a safe and a happy workplace. Obviously, there's all kinds of ways that that falls flat depending on the economy, but prison doesn't have that. You either have your job assignment that you have or you have no job.
Mm. And so how does something like a sick day happen when you're in prison and not showing up for labor in terms of what options or what sort of agency does an individual have to say, I can't do the work?
Yeah, very little, very little. You know, there are some states, obviously, that handle it differently than others. There are some wardens, individual facilities that handle it differently than others. But there's nothing stopping a prison from, for instance, penalizing somebody for not showing up from work. And I've heard from inmates who have said, you know, if you have the flu and you don't show up for work one day, you get a write-up, a disciplinary ticket. And that can have all kinds of consequences for when you go before the parole board, for instance, or from if you're applying for less restrictive housing. Having a ticket on your record, and depending on how they characterize not showing up for work, you know, that could be characterized as disobeying an order. That's very serious. Mm-hmm. And there's no rules against that, at least not from a federal perspective or from sort of an oversight perspective.
This hour, we're talking about prison labor, how much a part of it is of the national economy, why it exists the way it does, how it works, and efforts to reform it. You can join the conversation at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. If you or a loved one has served time in a prison, did that time involve labor, voluntary or involuntary? What was the experience like? I'd love to hear your experience. Give us a call at 651-227-6000. Ruben Garcia, you mentioned earlier the 13th Amendment. I think we need to spend a little bit more time on that. Many prison reform advocates trace the roots of prison labor back to the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery in 1865. Why the loophole in the amendment that says nobody can be forced to work for no pay unless they've committed a crime, they've been found guilty of committing a crime?
Well, I think it goes back to the historical context of 1865 and the definite, as I said earlier, the definite concern that when you have millions of people in slavery and they are the labor force of agriculture in several states, that there is the need again for a replacement labor force. But I think, you know, also there were a lot of programs, and I think there's been many historians that have touched on these in terms of leasing out convicts to do labor, convict leasing programs. And you just, I think you just, again, saw a number of ways, including debt bondage, having people work off their debt after the end of slavery, that were intended to replicate slavery without, again, after 1865. So what you then have is the Supreme Court and a number of courts saying that these schemes, you know, are replications of the system that the 13th Amendment was intended to abolish. And you again have several cases that put any time a relationship that seems voluntary on its face, is so coercive that it rises to the level of a 13th Amendment violation. The court stepped in and said, you know, that these relationships can't exist anywhere mm-hmm. in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that is, you know, again, I think that's the basic kind of history. But as I said, things have developed since then in the workforce and in the labor force. And I think what Beth said earlier is the number of ways in which prisoners, besides not having a minimum wage, are, you know, considered not employees and therefore don't have any of the rights to workers' compensation or health and safety, all the things that we take for granted as flowing from being considered employees mm-hmm. are not available to non-employees. So what the courts decide in terms of a prisoner's employee or non-employee status is pretty critical for a number of different protections.
So we have a loophole in the Constitution that allows for free or nearly free labor if the person has been found guilty of a crime. But we also have the Fair Labor Standards Act that requires contractors to pay minimum wage for inmate work. So how is it that so many prisoners are often making less than a dollar an hour?
Courts have consistently found that prisoners are not subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that's exactly why, as Ruben was saying, prisoners aren't allowed to unionize, for instance. A lot of the protections that free world workers take for granted are not available to workers in prison because they're not considered workers under the act.
Mm. Ruben, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to say that. But also, again, it's a broad question that I think different courts or different cases could raise in different ways, because it is not in the text of the law that prisoners should be automatically excluded. It's courts interpreting what it means to be an employee and mm-hmm. what it means to be under the control of an employer, which is the usual test for those of us on the outside. But who can imagine a system more controlled than being in a prison, right? You know, and so it's hard to see how some of those decisions couldn't come out a different way in the future. But until there is clarification, I guess, from legislation, there's no definitive word on employee or non-employee status.
Beth, I've heard some arguments from the correctional facility saying, look, running a prison is a very expensive thing, so we're garnering those wages in order to pay for the cost of food, health care, all these other services that, you know, we have to pay for in order to keep these prisoners. Does that
make— I think that's true. I mean, they're telling the truth. Running prisons is very expensive. And I think that if I think prison administrators have been very open and very honest about the fact that if they had to pay prisoners a fair wage, or even a minimum wage, then the whole system would just collapse. I mean, that is just a fact. You can't incarcerate, you know, millions of people and pay them all of them a fair wage for doing the things that need to be done to run the prison. You know, prisoners are washing the laundry, they're cooking the food, they're serving the food, they're cleaning the facility, they're mowing the lawns. I mean, everything you can imagine that needs to get done in a prison, prisoners are doing it, and they're doing it for pennies or nickels a day. And it's just a fact that if they were paid a minimum wage or more, the prison system would collapse. It just would. That's true.
But on the other hand, we also talk about the prison system, the incarceration system, you know, which has become massively privatized, as being a, you know, multi-billion-dollar industry off of which thousands of corporations are profiting. So how is it that we have, on the one hand, we're talking about, you know, needing to garner minimum wage salaries for these prisoners in order to pay for their health care. But we also have, you know, a list of 3,000 corporations or so who are profiting from massive contracts.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, that is certainly a thorn, as thorny an ethical issue, or as a much less fuzzy ethical issue than a state run facility. I just want to be clear, private prisons, though they are sort of a lightning rod issue, are a very small proportion of the number of prisons in this country, and they hold a small proportion of the number of prisoners in this country. But it's true. And in fact, when the UN has looked at this issue, they did draw a very bright line between labor done in the service of running a state-run prison and labor done in the service of running a private prison. And the UN characterized labor by inmates in a private prison setting that's not paid or not paid adequately as slavery, where they sort of stop short of calling it that when you're talking about a public facility. One place where this is an especially thorny issue is when you have a private prison that's detaining immigrants and forcing them to work, or underpaying them for their work. Because in that case, you have a private U.S. corporation employing people who have specifically been identified as undocumented immigrants, which is to say they are not allowed to work in this country. And here you have a private prison detaining them, employing them, and not paying them a fair wage. There's something definitely ethically dubious about that.
Oh. We're talking this hour. Ruben?
Just add to what Beth said, there's been a lot of litigation against those companies that run immigration detention centers. And here the 13th Amendment, by its terms, doesn't apply because they haven't been convicted of any crime at this point. So that is a real, as she said, real authority issue currently.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this hour about prison labor in the United States, efforts to reform it, its history and ties to racism and the 13th Amendment. And we're taking your calls. You can join the conversation at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Let's go to the phone. We've got Nathan on the line in Stuart. Nathan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I had a past addiction that I'm now free from, and through that I spent much time in incarceration. And one time in particular, I was in Hennepin County Workhouse making dog chains for $7 an hour, which they called industry. And there was a feeling, well, it was quite a privilege, is that the way they treat it, to be in that program, first of all. And it was, because it got you away from the environment of your cell, first of all. And even though it was only $7 an hour, it helped, but I'm sure, you know, it could have been more.
And $7 per hour or $7 per day?
Oh, a day, I'm sorry. $7 per day. And it was a feeling like, you know, I didn't feel like a slave or nothing like that. I felt like a privilege. Mm-hmm. To be out of my cell, you know, just doing something and making some money at it. But I can see how, you know, they're taking advantage of that. You know, they were profiting off me much more. But there was an overall feeling that it was a privilege.
All right, Nathan, stand by. Beth, you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Nathan, if you had a job that wasn't in that work program, did you have jobs behind the walls? And how much did you make at those jobs, just by comparison? Because $7 a day is a lot by prison standards.
Yes. There was, I think the kitchen was 50 cents, a quarter for mopping, and it wasn't much at all. So, you know, it was an option, you know, to do other things, but that paid more.
Gotcha. All right. Nathan, thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience. I really appreciate it. Beth, I think we need to back up a moment and talk about the concept of rehabilitation through work. I mean, there is a basis for wanting prisoners to work while they're incarcerated, right?
Oh, certainly. And I don't think you'll find anybody who says that people who are incarcerated shouldn't work. I mean, even prisoners themselves, like Nathan just said, folks want to work, right? Nobody wants to sit in their cell all day. And if the work is meaningful and it can earn them a little bit of money, all the better, right? I mean, if you can get, all of us have that experience of getting up in the morning and wanting to feel excited about what they have to go do that day and feeling like they're contributing to making the world better in some way. So I don't think anybody is advocating not giving prisoners that opportunity. I think the sticking point for prisoners advocates is the conditions under which people are working, the amount that they're being paid and the protections that they're being offered in the course of their work.
Mm-hmm. Ruben?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And again, just point out that this is exactly the kind of control or coercion that the Fair Labor Standards Act was meant to deal with, and to try and make sure that at least there is a minimum standard. And other statutes, of course, after in terms of health and safety and doing dangerous work. You know, no one should have to consent or to dangerous conditions or sub minimum conditions, you know, and particularly when you're talking about that, you know, in that kind of a controlled environment. I think it's exactly why we need some more regulation.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Brad on the line from Minnetonka. Brad, welcome to the conversation.
Carrie, I love being on with you. I feel famous for just a minute a day.
Excellent. What's your comment, Brad?
So, I mean, we keep talking about prison reform, and I just think that your guests, their arguments are a little nonsensical. We keep referring to prisoners as employees and prisons as the employer, but I think prisoners forfeited that right when they broke the law and got sent to prison.
Mm-hmm.
At what point are we as a society going to stop babysitting grown adults who make mistakes and stop making arguments for them and make sure that they pay their due and their debt to society? And sometimes when you're paying a debt, you're not going to get reimbursed for it.
All right, Brad. Thanks. Appreciate your comment. Beth, so if they're working, they're getting three hots and a cot, where's the punishment?
Well, let's remember, first of all, that prisons serve multiple purposes. Punishment is one of them, but rehabilitation is another. And I also will say that there's something self-defeating about not paying prisoners more for their work, because don't forget, most people go home. And if you go home with $0 in your pocket, you are in a somewhat desperate situation. You're not setting somebody up for success if you'd send them home and you say, now that you've served your time, go home and follow the law. Don't do anything illegal. Find yourself a place to live. Find yourself food to eat, and do that in a legal way with no money. So I don't know if anybody who's ever tried to find an apartment where they'll take you in without a first month's rent and a security deposit. I don't know anybody who has been able to feed themselves with no money in their pocket. And so I don't think this is about making excuses for people necessarily. I think it's about smart policy. You know, I think it's the same kind of thing that comes into play where people say, well, that they resent prisoners getting an education when they're in prison, right? Because we have to pay for our children's education. Why should taxpayers be paying for people in prison to get an education? And I completely get why there's something sort of morally satisfying about saying that. But again, if we want people to get out and not commit more crimes, which I think we all agree is the point of corrections, it's called corrections for a reason, setting people up for success is the best way to do that. The other thing I'll say about this is that research shows that when parents go to prison, it's not just they themselves that are being punished. They're minor children, and there are millions of minor children in this country with a parent in prison. Their significant other is left on the outside to raise their minor children with one less income. And so you set up their spouses or their significant others, their parent, their children's other parent, to use government benefits like welfare, like food stamps, because they have less income to support these children. And so, again, while it feels sort of morally satisfying to say that, you're sort of like stealing from Peter to pay Paul, because you're now paying for this person's three hots and a cot, but now you're also paying to help support their children because they're not making an income to support their children anymore. And so there is something just pragmatically not very effective about that position.
Ruben Garcia, you talk about the prison labor reform as being a humanitarian issue. Why is that?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I mean, I think we have to recognize, first of all, you know, that there are limits to what prisoners should be subject to, even as being convicted of a crime. I mean, I think, again, the perception that prisoners give up all human rights when they are doing their sentence is a common one, but it is at odds, I think, with both the Constitution and human rights norms around the world. So the usual discussion is what rights should prisoners have, not should they have no rights, or what level of minimum standards are humane in terms of incarceration. So I think there's a number of discussions we could have on that front. But again, with regard to labor standards or minimum labor standards, certainly, you know, again, the right to be free of recognized hazards in any workplace, I think, is a human right. The basic you know, protection against discrimination, another human right, but also, again, the idea that, you know, within the prison system, that there is some minimal standard to make sure that you don't have unfair competition, again, between industries who are using prison labor and those that are not. So I think, you know, what rights those are, I think, continue to be in discussion. But I think as a matter of international law and a matter of the Constitution, we know that there are some basic minimums that all governments should adhere to.
Beth Schwartzoffel, you mentioned earlier this hour that if we paid the about half of the 1.6 million people in state prisons have jobs. Am I right on that? So that's what, 800,000 people approximately?
That's about right, yeah.
Okay. So if we paid them a minimum wage, the system would collapse. Can't do it.
Basically. I mean, there's no way.
So what is the way forward then? I mean, you're saying that people should get that prisoners should be paid a basic minimum wage in order to support their families outside of prison, prepare themselves for transition into the workplace post-prison term. So how? But you're saying that's not possible.
I guess it depends on who you ask. And I just want to clarify, too, as a reporter, I'm not here to necessarily advocate for any one of these positions.
Sure.
I'm just here to sort of point out what people are arguing in different sides of things. I think that one way that we see states handling it is in situations like the one that Nathan described, where you have a sort of work release kind of context, or where you have somebody who is able to work something resembling a free world job. And in fact, the interesting thing is programs like the one you mentioned in your intro, like where prisoners are working for free world companies, those are a tiny, tiny sliver of prison jobs in this country. I mean, in the order of thousands, as opposed to, you know, when there are more than a million people in prison in this country, we're talking about a couple of thousand maybe that have these jobs with private companies.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is, even though these are the most controversial types of jobs, among critics, those are designed specifically to address the problem that you're pointing out, which is how do we give prisoners meaningful works where they can make a meaningful income without putting a burden on the prison system? Now, I think that this particular solution raises a whole host of other problems, but I just wanted to point out that that's kind of why those jobs were designed the way they were designed.
Right.
I think that there are some advocates who would say, well, I think the solution is put less people in prison, right? I mean, ask yourself, is every single person in prison really, do they really need to be there? Or would society and them and their families, and not to mention their victims, be better served by them being out in the world and making a real wage so that they can pay victims compensation, so that they can pay their court fines and fees, so that they can actually make a contribution to society instead of being a drain on society by costing the state money to incarcerate them? I mean, that is one solution, right? It's just to lock less people up. I don't think there, you know, under the current system, is there a good solution? I have not heard of one.
Ruben Garcia, what about you?
And I would add that there's still a lot of research and data that needs to be gathered in terms of the effectiveness of these programs as a transition. And again, I think what Beth is mentioning also goes to the idea that some of these, what we think of as prison labor jobs, may be, you know, more transition into reentry. But we don't know. I don't think we have the data to know exactly, you know, how these jobs are being used and how effective they are. If their goal is to transition people back into the world, that is being effective. And I think, you know, if you have a lot of private companies in having these contracts, then it's going to be harder to get the data than if the government is the one actually doing these programs, and the government would be required under public records laws to get certain information about how they're working. But if you have a large number of them through private contracts, those would be harder. That'd be harder information to get.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Russ on the line in St. Cloud. Russ, welcome to the conversation.
Hello.
Hi there. What's your comment?
My comment is that while a prisoner is getting three hots in the cot, that their wage, even at minimum wage, may represent looking at them receiving a dollar an hour is going to be their discretionary income portion of that wage. And their normal expenses and cost of living should be explained to them in the transition and teaching of rehabilitation of these prisoners. You know, their food, roof, health care, yard, TV, weights, whatever they get is part of their cost of living, and that doesn't represent, you know, they're not, they shouldn't get 100% of their income anyway. So it could be explained to them that they're getting their discretionary portion of their income.
Okay. Thanks for that, Russ. Beth, what do you think of that?
Well, I've heard different reactions to those kind of arguments. I've heard people say, well, this isn't exactly the life that they've chosen for themselves, right? I mean, that's different from somebody signing on to a program or a home where
a condo association fee.
Exactly. It's not like they got to negotiate for the rent that felt fair, or they got to choose the amenities that they want to pay for and not choose the amenities they didn't want to pay for. I mean, I certainly think that, you know, if somebody is going to be a drain on taxpayers as a result of choices that they made, it makes perfect sense from that point of view to require them to pay in. And in fact, many of these jobs do require people to pay a certain proportion of their incarceration. But just to point out that these are often breadwinners who have left behind a family that is paying rent in the free world and is paying for food in the free world. And so by withholding income from people for, you know, again, rent that they didn't necessarily choose to pay, you're also withholding money from their partners and minor children who are still out in the free world trying to put food on the table.
I think also it's important to note the context of that we have prisoners who are also facing really mounting costs for what they, for things like a 15-minute local call, we'll call, you know, sometimes cost $17. That's more, that's 20 days labor if you're working at less than a dollar a day. Then there's
not
also,
to mention,
go ahead.
Not to mention, prisoners have to pay for a wide range of things that most people don't know about. So for instance, toiletries, most prisoners are required to purchase their own toiletries like deodorant, toothpaste, toothbrush. They're required to purchase their own underwear, their own socks, their own sneakers, things like that. And they have one place to choose from, which is the prison canteen. And so, again, there's no competition on prices. And the other thing is that many prisoners are required to pay a copay for their medical care. So, for instance, every time you want to see the doctor, you have to pay a dollar or $5. And there was some research recently that shows that a dollar to an incarcerated worker is the equivalent of $580 to somebody on the outside. So that's kind of the equivalent of saying every time you want to go see the doctor, you have to pay a $580 copay. So again, this isn't necessarily about like making apologies for people, as one of your earlier callers pointed out. It's just looking at the hard numbers that, again, there's some sort of moral satisfaction in saying that you did the crime, you have to do the time, this is the consequences of your actions. But just as far as dollars and cents is concerned, it's a hugely disproportionate what prisoners have to spend on basics as compared to what people have to spend on the outside.
Ruben Garcia, you wanted to add something there?
Well, I just wanted to point out that there is some precedent for what Russ, I think, was saying about, you know, counting the costs of different things that, quote, the employer provides. And that again, is a discussion that can be had once you accept the premise that they are employees. And there's an employer who can say, well, I provided you meals, you know, and this is your statement for all the meals that I provided you. And so that's factored into your wages. So again, we can have that discussion if we're talking about employees or employers under the law. But I think again, it goes back to the fact that, you know, as taxpayers, you know, we are also subsidizing, you know, these private companies, you know, in terms of the cost of incarceration. So I think that it's a very important, you know, point to make, or a very important discussion to have about, you know, the level of subsidy that we might be providing to private companies who are using this prison labor.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line in St. Cloud. John, welcome to the conversation.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. No, you know what? I've been incarcerated, and when I got there, it was 25 cents an hour to work, and they took half of your wage for your gate fee, your fine or restitution, or child support. And in my time in there, like I said, you know, the phone calls were 37 cents a minute, which you obviously making 25 cents an hour and they're taking half for everything else. You got to work several hours just to be able to have contact with your family or your kids, unless you do it by the mail, which they keep raising up the envelope prices there as well. And with canteen, you know, like the lady was saying, there ain't no, you know, there's no competition in there, which for a ramen noodle, that's 95 cents. I mean, that's just kind of ridiculous, I think. And when we get out of prison, we are in worse debt than we were when we went in. And we have to try to find a job to that pays at least something so we can get caught up again. And in my case, I drive semi. It took 5 years for a lot of companies after you get out of prison for you to even be able to reply or apply for a job, because you're still doing the time even though you're not incarcerated. So with this whole wage thing, it's putting a big burden on your whole family as well as yourself. The extortion of people inside the prison is high because other people have things they don't, which causes a lot of fights and kids getting extorted, or people, I should say. And I mean, it's just, to me, it makes no sense. If you're trying to rehabilitate somebody, why not try to ease the burden of when they get out, what's going to happen to them? I got out with almost $27,000 in debt, more than I was when I went in.
Yeah. All right, John, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your experience. I appreciate it. Beth?
And I just wanted to point out that John was saying if ramen noodles cost 95 cents in prison and he was bringing home 12 and a half cents an hour, he had to work 7.6 hours to be able to afford a packet of ramen noodles. Now, if you applied the minimum wage to that, that would be the equivalent of us on the outside paying $60 for a package of ramen noodles. So that just kind of puts in perspective what you're talking about when you're asking prisoners to sort of, quote unquote, pay their way and at the same time paying them so little.
You know, Beth, John also brought up the idea of, you know, when he gets out and being able to find a job. And that's something we haven't really talked much about. It's hard not to see the irony when we were looking at the campfires in California, that there were these professional firefighters working alongside prison firefighters, but once that prisoner finishes serving his or her time, they can't use that work experience to get a job. They're disqualified from the being a firefighter because of their criminal record.
Yeah, my colleague Abby Van Sickle, who does reporting for us out of California, found that when she was talking to a number of these fire programs, that folks were really proud of the work they were doing. It gave them an opportunity to get out of the prison. It gave them opportunity to be outside, to be in a camp setting, and to do really meaningful work that was contributing to their community. And then they got out and wanted to keep up with it, and they could not get jobs because fire departments exclude people with felony convictions from working as firefighters. And so it does sort of reveal a little bit of the lie that this is rehabilitative in nature. I mean, I do think there's something rehabilitative in, you know, being answerable to somebody. And I've heard a lot of correctional industries professionals tell me this, that folks go into prison, they've never shown up at a job a day in their life. Maybe they've worked dealing drugs, or maybe they've worked made money in the past by working in the sort of underground economy, maybe stealing. And so just the accountability of having to show up at work every day is rehabilitative in its way and does send you out into the world with some skills you didn't have before, learning to answer to a boss, learning to dress professionally, learning how to speak professionally and handle yourself in a professional setting. So, you know, I don't want to discount those people's opinions on the subject, but there is something kind of ironic about people learning skills on the inside in the name of rehabilitation that they actually can't use when they get out.
Mm. Ruben Garcia, when we look at the states and the federal government and the reluctance around prison labor reform, why are they not more eager to make some substantial changes given what you see as the humanitarian nature of the problem?
Well, I think right off the bat, because they are not voters or not a big voting bloc. And I think, you know, some moves to restore, to re-enfranchise felons, I think, you know, may help in that regard. But
you mean be able to reinstate their voting rights?
Reinstate their voting rights, yes.
Okay.
And they're still a politically powerless minority, right? So that is a, you know, again, not going to be government officials are not going to be very responsive to non-voters, right? And so that's what we know. I think, if we look at the California fire example, I mean, that may, you know, cause some people to, especially, you know, as I understand it, you know, that they, you know, they were basically very important to that effort. And I think, you know, that just raises a whole lot of other issues about, you know, the safety conditions that prisoners are going to be under in a number of different jobs. And is how everything flows from, you know, the integrated nature of everything flowing from employment status. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that, again, the idea of seeing this as a problem that it's not just about having prisoners earn the minimum wage is really important as well, because we know, as we heard, that, you know, there's ban the box rules that prevent prisoners from getting employment because of their conviction. And so there's a lot of reform on that front as well. So I think it's a very much an integrated nature going forward that is not just, again, about labor reform, but a number of other reform efforts that are ongoing.
Got it.
In many states.
Let's go back to the phones. We got time for one last caller. Let's go to Steve from Park Rapids. Steve, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Share your experience with us.
Well, it's a little different, but it gets to, the meat of the problem, if you will. After living in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, I spent 20 years as a specialist in the inner city. In fact, a lot of laws that took place there I was involved in helping create based on experience. And what I had there was a 2% shortage loss as a retailer. So total, that's a lot. Normally, we run at 0.80. And it was too expensive, but I broke away and did something nobody had done, and then I did background checks. They were expensive, and in the inner city, as we know from many of the states, those are where a lot of our crime comes from. At the same time that I did this check, I was hitting 25% felons. And in a year's time, I took my percentage loss from 2% to 1%, which is a huge amount of money, and we were suffering the hardship of it. Other businesses were actually moving out because of crime.
Can you tell me, help me to understand, so you went from 2% to 1%. To what do you attribute that change?
Well, the background checks allowed me to see that I was hiring a felon. I didn't hire him then.
Ah, and so you stopped hiring felons.
I stopped hiring felons, and actually, because of the legal ramifications, I didn't hire misdemeanors either. The problem there was is it solved a huge problem for me as a retailer, and many other people joined in, and eventually everybody was doing background checks because they did pay for themselves. The problem was, is the city was so overwhelmed with crime that, and all of them are, Milwaukee's the same way with their hub, as an example, in Wisconsin, and the police forces haven't been growing to keep up.
I'm going to need you to wrap up, Steve, because we only got a couple minutes here. So what's your point?
Okay. My point is that after all of this, I then went into the situation that I felt bad, because it used to be when you served your time, you paid your debt to society. Well, mm-hmm. That's not the case anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, once you're convicted of a crime, everybody can see that, and you don't have a chance of returning out there and surviving. You can't. How could you? There's people that don't have that have trouble finding a job and surviving today's world.
Yeah. But for you as a business owner, it made economic sense to... You saw an immediate economic benefit of not hiring felons, and that sort of compelled you to move that direction.
But the downside is that we need to, as a country, realize that if you want them to ever succeed, you have to, once you've paid your debt, that's off there. Yeah. Unless, of course, it's a crime against people, and it's different. But otherwise, nobody is ever going to survive, and it's a cycle that turns. And keeps turning. And how can you? I don't see how anybody in today's market could leave prison and go out in the world and find a job and make it.
Steve, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. Beth, does that resonate with you? The research you've done around prisoners trying to re-enter the workforce?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's been just reams of research that shows that people with a criminal record, especially if you're an African-American with a criminal record, I mean, the odds are stacked so against you that it's true. I mean, it is It seems like an insurmountable problem, right, to get back on your feet and rejoin the above ground economy. And again, if we want to, as a society, set people up to succeed, to set them up in a system where they, if they want to follow the law, they can follow the law, then it's hard to imagine a worse way to do that than to make it impossible for them to find a job, release them with no savings, and with job training for a job that they cannot do. You're basically setting people up to continue to break the law because people have to eat and they have to have a place to live.
So I want to take the last few minutes here to talk about the potential for reform at the state and federal level. Ruben, we talked earlier about the lack of incentive. Beth, do you see in the stories that you're telling that there's an appetite for reform at this point that didn't exist beforehand?
Well, I certainly think on a national level in the last number of years, we've started to have a conversation about the sort of behemoth that is our criminal justice system. And we've started to, as a country, have a little bit of an appetite to dial it back a little bit. I mean, I think the most recent example of this is that the Senate is set to vote on this criminal justice bill, the First Step Act. And it's looking like it will probably pass at some point before the end of the year. And that's huge. I mean, that's the first time we've had any sort of real large-scale reform as far as the federal prison system is concerned in quite a number of years. I think advocates are saying it's a really good example of how reform comes slowly. It's a sort of compromise upon a compromise sort of bill that does make sort of modest reforms. But I think the fact that the country's even willing to go there does say something about our sort of national dawning awareness that the criminal justice system is overlarge and not really working.
Mm. Ruben Garcia, just one minute left here. Your thoughts on potential for reform right now?
Well, I agree with Beth that there's definitely appetite for some reform in terms of mass incarceration. But where we started in terms of the idea of labor conditions within prisons, I think it's a much longer road. And I think as I and other scholars have tried to excavate the history of the 13th Amendment and just to know what a pull that has been on sort of the consciousness of courts and the public in terms of this idea that if you're in prison, that you're not a worker.
We've got to wrap it up.
It's going to be a much longer road on that one.
All right. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Ruben Garcia, professor of law and co-director of the UNLV Workplace Law Program in Las Vegas, and Beth Schwartzoffel, a staff writer at the Marshall Project in Boston. Thank you so much to both of you for being a part of this hour. Great conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you'll probably want to tune in on Monday at 11 a.m. when Angela Davis takes a look at incarceration and mental health in Minnesota. That's Monday at 11. Coming up next, it's 1A with host Joshua Johnson.
'Cause you done convicted me of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, reckon that.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.